Hi, I'm Amy Goodman. In this critical election year, you count on Democracy Now! To stay focused on the stories that matter most. And we count on you to support our independent journalism. If everyone who tunes into Democracy Now! Signed up for a monthly donation of, say, just $6, we could cover our operating costs for the entire year. Really, that's all it would take. Please do your part today by visiting us at democracynow.org. Stay safe. Wear a mask, save lives, and thank you so much. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Senator, I see no conflict between having a sincerely held faith and duties as a judge. In fact, we have many judges, both state and federal, across the country who have sincerely held religious views and still impartially and honestly discharge their obligations as a judge.
President Trump's reportedly leaning towards tapping right-wing federal judge Amy Coney Barrett to fill Ruth Bader Ginsburg's seat on the Supreme Court, a move opposed by reproductive rights, LGBTQ and civil rights groups. We'll speak to the editor of the National Catholic Reporter about Barrett's involvement in a secretive, ultra-conservative Catholic group where female leaders were once referred to as handmaids. Some have likened the group to the one that inspired Margaret Atwood's dystopian novel, The Handmaid's Tale. We'll also speak to a former member of the group who likens it to a cult. Then, no mas bebés, or no more babies.
The doctor walked in and said, we cut your tubes, and I said, why? He goes, well, you signed for it. I said, me? I go, I don't remember nothing. And I didn't tell my family. I didn't tell anybody.
Some of them signed right in the midst of labor. Some of them don't even remember signing. Here is this young lawyer, and for the first time telling them, do you know that you've been sterilized?
As immigration authorities say they've stopped sending women to a Georgia gynecologist accused of sterilizing female prisoners without their consent, we continue our look at the nation's disturbing history of forced sterilization. We'll speak to historian Virginia Espino about 10 Chicana women who sued after being sterilized at Los Angeles County Hospital in late 60s and 70s. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The official United States death toll from COVID-19 has passed 200,000, by far the highest in the world, as University of Washington researchers warn the U.S. is on track to double that death toll by year's end. In the past 24 hours alone, the U.S. reported nearly 1,000 new deaths and over 37,000 new cases, with Minnesota, Montana, Utah, Wisconsin, and Wyoming reporting record levels of infections over the past week. On Tuesday, the COVID-19 Memorial Project placed 20,000 flags across the National Mall, each one symbolizing 10 U.S. residents who've died of the disease since the first recorded U.S. death in February. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi spoke at a memorial for the dead.
This was preventable. Not all of it, but much of it. And what could be lost in the future is preventable, too, if we embrace science. Science instead of politics.
The New York Times reports the Food and Drug Administration is planning to issue stricter guidelines on any emergency use authorization of a coronavirus vaccine, even as President Trump promises a vaccine will be available as early as next month. The FDA's emerging guidelines would affirm the warnings of researchers who say they cannot guarantee the safety or efficacy of any of the vaccines currently in clinical trials in such a short period of time. The Washington Post reports Pentagon officials spent most of a $1 billion coronavirus relief fund on jet engine parts, spy satellites, drones, body armor, and dress uniforms for troops. The money was allocated by Congress under the CARES Act and was meant to combat the pandemic. This comes as hospitals around the United States continue to report serious shortages of N95 masks and other medical supplies. Meanwhile, President Trump continues to hold campaign rallies with his supporters packed shoulder to shoulder with few wearing masks. On Monday, as the death toll approached 200,000 with nearly 7 million U.S. infections, Trump told a crowd in Ohio COVID-19 only impacts elderly people with heart problems and other problems.
But it affects virtually nobody. It's an amazing thing. By the way, open your schools. Everybody, open your schools.
At least six teachers have died since the start of fall classes alone, with the independent COVID monitor group recording more than 21,000 coronavirus cases linked to U.S. schools this school year. On Tuesday, the Miami-Dade County School District said students will be able to choose next month whether to return to their classrooms for in-person instruction. Here in New York, the United Nations General Assembly got underway Tuesday with world leaders and most UN ambassadors participating remotely due to the pandemic. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres warned against a new Cold War between the U.S. and China.
Our world cannot afford a future where the two largest economies split the globe in a great fracture, each with its own trade and financial rules and internet and artificial intelligence capacities. A technological and economic divide risks inevitably turning into a geostrategic and military divide, and we must avoid this at all costs.
President Trump also addressed the UN General Assembly Tuesday, criticizing China during a pre-taped 7-minute address, the shortest ever given by a U.S. president.
We must hold accountable the nation which unleashed this plague onto the world, China.
Chinese President Xi Jinping of China also spoke and vowed to make China carbon neutral by 2060, with carbon emissions peaking within 10 years. She called on nations to, quote, achieve a green recovery of the world economy in the post-COVID era. Utah Republican Senator Mitt Romney said Tuesday he'll support a floor vote for President Trump's nominee to replace Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who died last week at the age of 87.
My liberal friends have, over many decades, gotten very used to the idea of having a liberal court, and that's not written in the stars.
Romney's announcement means Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has the support of 51 Republican senators, enough to rapidly push forward with a vote on Justice Ginsburg's replacement. There are just 41 days remaining before the November election. In 2016, McConnell refused to hold confirmation hearings for President Obama's nominee to replace Justice Antonin Scalia, who died nearly 9 months before the election. At the time, McConnell said, quote, the American people should have a voice in the selection of their next Supreme Court justice. Louisville, Kentucky remains in a state of emergency as the city prepares for a grand jury decision in the police killing of Breonna Taylor. Police fatally shot the 26-year-old black emergency room technician in her own home on March 13th. Ahead of the announcement, the Louisville Police Department announced it's conducting an internal review of six officers involved in the shooting and raid. One of the officers being investigated, Sergeant John Mattingly, has defended his actions. In an email to 1,000 other officers, Mattingly wrote, quote, regardless of the outcome today or Wednesday, I know we did the legal, moral, and ethical thing that night, he said. In the email, he also called protesters, quote, thugs, saying this is not an us against society, but it is good versus evil. The Nation magazine's reporting federal officials with the Justice Department and Homeland Security have intercepted the phone communications of protesters in Portland, Oregon. The Nation reports surveillance involved in cell phone cloning, where the government steals a phone's unique identifiers and copies them to another device in order to intercept the communications received by the original device. Oregon Senator Jeff Merkley has called for a full investigation. He wrote on Twitter, quote, the Trump administration has treated the people of Portland like enemy combatants. These tactics, like cell phone cloning to spy on protesters, are unacceptable in America, he said. Russian opposition politician Alexei Navalny has been released from a German hospital where he was treated for suspected poisoning after he became violently ill aboard a flight from Siberia to Moscow in August. Ahead of his release, Navalny published a photo of himself looking gaunt but walking without assistance. Doctors say it's too early to tell if the longtime critic of Vladimir Putin will make a complete recovery. German scientists say they discovered traces of the banned nerve agent Novichok on a water bottle used by Navalny shortly before he fell ill. In Washington, a reporter asked President Trump Tuesday about Navalny's poisoning.
Who do you think poisoned Alexei Navalny in Russia?
We'll talk about that at another time.
In Belarus, President Alexander Lukashenko was abruptly sworn in at a secret ceremony today amidst ongoing anti-government protests demanding the longtime authoritarian leader resign. The opposition denounced the ceremony as illegitimate following Lukashenko's landslide win in last month's election, which critics say was rigged. In Cleveland, Ohio, a 28-year-old transgender woman who died in her cell at Cuyahoga County Jail last month left a hidden letter denouncing the jail's horrid conditions. The letter was found by her mother after picking up her daughter's belongings. In the letter, Lee Day wrote, prisoners were served food that was cold, smelled bad, tasted like cleaning chemicals. Day said the jail also failed to provide cleaning supplies and that the conditions had only gotten worse during the COVID-19 pandemic. The Cleveland Plain Dealer reports her mother says Day was being held in an area of the jail reserved for men. Questions remain on what caused her death. In immigration news, women imprisoned at Erwin County Detention Center in Georgia are no longer being sent to the physician accused of administering hysterectomies and other gynecological procedures without consent. An attorney working on the investigation said Tuesday Dr. Mahendra Amin saw at least 60 women imprisoned at Erwin, which is privately run. Whistleblower Dawn Wooten, a former nurse at Erwin, labeled Amin the, quote, uterus collector. Meanwhile, Mexico's government is demanding U.S. authorities address allegations of forced sterilizations at Erwin, where at least six Mexican women may have had unwanted hysterectomies. This is Mexico's Foreign Minister Marcelo Ebrard speaking Tuesday.
It is something that is unacceptable, and we reject it beforehand. Even in the United States, there is a reaction from important groups which we have been in contact with. This has to be cleared up. If it is confirmed, it would be a major issue and not only punished, but also other measures would be taken.
In California, immigration rights advocates continue to denounce Governor Gavin Newsom's orders to transfer people from state prisons to the custody of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. This comes as The Guardian reports 41-year-old Cal Saley, who fought wildfires as an incarcerated firefighter in 2018 and 19, was transferred to ICE custody last month, the day of his prison release. After 22 years behind bars for a robbery committed as a teen, Saley was sent to an immigration prison in Louisiana and is now facing deportation to Laos, the country his family fled when he was just 2 years old. New questions are being raised over why the Census Bureau cut short its data collection for the census by a month. A new report by the Commerce Department's internal watchdog reveals the decision did not come from the director of the census. In a report, the watchdog stated, quote, the schedule change was not the Bureau's decision. Senior officials at the Bureau, including the director, did not know who ultimately made the decision to accelerate the census schedule. The watchdog report also reveals there's a consensus within the Bureau that shortening the length of the data collection will, quote, negatively impact the accuracy of the census. In campaign news, Democratic vice presidential candidate Kamala Harris traveled to the battleground state of Michigan Tuesday, where she appealed to black voters to help defeat Donald Trump in November. This is Senator Harris speaking at an event in Detroit.
Why do you think they are trying to suppress and to make it difficult or to confuse black people around voting? And the answer is simple, because they know when we vote, things change.
Meanwhile, Joe Biden beat back a reporter's suggestion he would pursue a socialist agenda if elected president, taking a swipe at Vermont Independent Senator Bernie Sanders and his supporters. Biden was speaking to a local TV reporter in northeastern Wisconsin.
I beat the socialists. That's how I got elected. That's how I got the nomination. Do I look like a socialist? Look at my career, my whole career. I am not a socialist.
On Tuesday, Cindy McCain, the widow of the late Republican senator and 2008 presidential candidate John McCain, announced she will endorse Joe Biden for president. In Terre Haute, Indiana, federal prison officials strapped condemned prisoner William LaCroix to a gurney Tuesday evening and injected him with a single dose of the drug pentobarbital. Witnesses to the execution report, LaCroix's eyelids drew heavy, his midsection heaved uncontrollably for several minutes before his lips turned blue and he fell still. LaCroix was pronounced dead just after 9 p.m. local time. It was the sixth federal execution since the Trump administration ended a 17-year hiatus on federal death sentences. On Thursday, Christopher Villalva is scheduled to become the seventh federal prisoner to die by lethal injection this year. And a new audit reveals the University of California admitted at least 64 wealthy, mostly white students as, quote, favors to donors, family and friends over the past six academic years. The audit looked into admissions policies starting in 2013 at four University of California campuses, including UC Berkeley, where 42 applicants who were children of staff and major donors were admitted over other more qualified students. At other campuses, applicants were falsely designated as student-athlete recruits, even as they had little or no athletic skill. The California State Auditor says the admission of at least 400 other students was also questionable. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by my co-host Juan Gonzalez at his home in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, we begin today's show looking at the future of the Supreme Court. On Tuesday, Utah Republican Senator Mitt Romney said he'll support a floor vote for President Trump's nominee to replace Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who died last week at the age of 87.
My liberal friends have, over many decades, gotten very used to the idea of having a liberal court, and that's not written in the stars.
The announcement means Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has the support of 51 Republican senators he needs to rapidly push forward with a vote on Justice Ginsburg's replacement just 41 days before the November election. In 2016, McConnell refused to hold confirmation hearings for Merrick Garland, President Obama's nominee to replace Justice Antonin Scalia, who died nearly 9 months before the election. At the time, McConnell said, quote, the American people should have a voice in the selection of their next Supreme Court Justice. President Trump has said he will name his nominee by Saturday and that it will be a woman. The front runner appears to be U.S. Court of Appeals Judge Amy Coney Barrett, who met with Trump on Monday. Barrett is a devout Catholic who's taken conservative stances on abortion, gun rights, and immigration. The Human Rights Campaign has called her a, quote, absolute threat to LGBTQ rights, unquote. One issue that's likely to be raised if Judge Barrett is nominated to the Supreme Court is her membership in a secretive Catholic group called People of Praise. Members of the group pledge a lifelong loyalty oath to the group, which assigns each member a personal advisor known as heads for men and, until recently, handmaids for women. The secretive group has a strictly patriarchal structure in which men are the heads of household with power over their wives and families. The group has been described by some as cult-like. The Senate did not question Barrett about People of Praise directly during her 2017 confirmation hearing for the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit. But California Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein did question Barrett about her views on Roe v. Wade and her religious views.
Why is it that so many of us on this side have this very uncomfortable feeling that, you know, dogma and law are two different things? And I think whatever a religion is, it has its own dogma. The law is totally different. And I think in your case, Professor, when you read your speeches, the conclusion one draws is that the dogma lives loudly within you. And that's of concern when you come to big issues that large numbers of people have fought for years in this country.
I'm being considered for a position on a court of appeals, and there would be no opportunity to be a no vote on Roe. And as I said to the committee, well, I would faithfully apply all Supreme Court precedent.
This all comes as President Trump is scheduled to speak this morning at the National Catholic Prayer Breakfast. Well, for more, we're joined by Heidi Schlumpf. She's the executive editor of the National Catholic Reporter. In 2018, she wrote the piece Prospective Supreme Court Nominee Puts Spotlight on People of Praise. She's joining us from Chicago. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Heidi. Why don't you start off by telling us the brief biography of Amy Coney Barrett and what People of Praise is?
Thank you, Amy, so much for having me, and I'm happy to talk to you this morning. So Amy Coney Barrett is, your introduction said, a Catholic judge. She's also been a professor at the law school at the University of Notre Dame. She is a conservative judge, an originalist, as we would probably expect to be at the top of the list of this president and a leader in this party. I've seen some reporting that said she has been groomed for this moment since as early as her first year in law school by a group of faculty at the University of Notre Dame's law school who were strongly opposed to Roe versus Wade. So she's on the list from the Federalist Society, and we have a connection there to that National Catholic Prayer Breakfast that's about to start later this morning. The founder of the National Catholic Prayer Breakfast, Leonard Leo, was also the longtime leader of the Federalist Society, which has for decades been trying to reshape the judiciary, especially around some of these culture warrior issues like abortion and LGBT rights. So one of the reasons that Amy Barrett was not questioned about her membership in this group within Catholicism called the People of Praise is that she did not disclose it on her questionnaire back in 2017. But when her name was floated to the top of a list when Justice Kennedy retired back in 2018, that's when many people started asking questions about the People of Praise. So the People of Praise is a covenanted community, which means that its members sign a covenant or make a covenant to one another. And I just want to say at the beginning here that I don't think there's any thing wrong with practicing your faith. I'm a Catholic, and I think many people join groups of other like-minded people. The level of commitment that you see in these covenanted communities is admirable. However, because of some of the secretness and some of the beliefs of a number of these communities, as well as some allegations by members who have left of authoritarianism, there's some real concerns about whether her involvement in there will affect her ability to be impartial and fair as a judge.
And Heidi Schlumpf, could you talk about some of those alleged authoritarian practices, some of the descriptions that I've heard of this complete submission to the will of your husband and the involvement of leaders of the group in the most intimate parts of a family's functioning? Could you talk about some of those practices? And also, what is the response of the Catholic hierarchy to groups within the Catholic Church that, by all appearances, appear to be cults?
Yeah, so I would say, just to take your second question first, that the charismatic movement in the Catholic Church, which goes back to like the 1970s, is something that is accepted by the Catholic Church. But not everyone who is a charismatic Catholic, charismatic referring to someone who has a personal experience of God kind of directly through the Holy Spirit and often results in different gifts of the Holy Spirit, like speaking in tongues or healing or prophecy. So this whole idea of charismatic experience within Catholicism is something that the church is okay with. A number of these covenanted communities are kind of a subgroup of charismatics. And there's a number of these other communities that we've reported on at NCR Online several times, Word of God, Sword of the Spirit, Lord's Ranch, the Mother of God community. I looked specifically at the People of Praise, which, to be quite honest, has fewer criticisms than some of these other organizations. But what you have is a setup in which these members of the community, and there are about a little under 2,000 of them in the People of Praise, spread out over a various number of cities. Most of them are Catholic. But it is an ecumenical group. They belong to regular parishes and worship at their local church. But then usually on Sunday afternoons, they get together for their own sort of prayer service. And then they also may meet in smaller groups throughout the week, single gender groups. But then you're asking about this idea that they have a head or someone who is kind of like a spiritual advisor. And for a man, their spiritual advisor would be another man in the community. For a single woman, your spiritual advisor would be another woman. But within marriage, the wife's spiritual advisor is her husband. And this whole language of handmaiden, which of course is scriptural, and obviously has a very negative connotation now because of the Margaret Atwood book and series, is something that sort of reinforces a patriarchy that not only this group, but a number of evangelical Christians have that see husbands as the head of the family and the decision makers, and consequently women in a more submissive or subordinate role. So there's also founders of some of these groups, not so much as a problem with People of Praise, that have some history of being very authoritarian. The decisions that a head might discuss with their advisee, I guess, could be anything around where you should live, who you should marry, where your children should go to school. But a member that I interviewed who was a current member said it's everything from those kinds of important decisions to us, you know, redecorating their house. So there's nothing wrong, again, with somebody having a spiritual advisor. But the secrecy involved in this organization does raise some red flags, as do some of the reports from people who have left.
And who is the leadership of the People of Praise, given that the fact that the members pledge loyalty to the group? And obviously the decisions of the leaders would have an influence, let's say, in the case of Amy Barrett.
Yeah, so the leader I spoke to back in 2018, who I believe is still the head, is Craig Lent. He is a professor at Notre Dame. And I will tell you, I know a number of folks in South Bend. I'm a Notre Dame grad myself, who know people who belong to the People of Praise, or I know people who send their children to the People of Praise's schools. So they have a number of private schools, including in South Bend. And what I hear from them is they're perfectly nice people and very, you know, very normal. That said, because there is a level of secrecy, for example, I tried very hard to get a copy of the covenant, which I understand is a few sentences that the covenanted members make to one another, and they were very reluctant to have that be public in any way. So those kinds of secrecy things, I think, are what bring people to use language about like cults. I'm not sure that I would call it a cult, but I would say that some of those concerns about authoritarianism, secrecy, it is true. I heard from a number of other members that I spoke with or chat rooms where I read what they were saying, is that when they were trying to leave the organization, there was a level of shunning of them as well.
I wanted to ask you about this pledging of lifelong loyalty to the group, which assigns each member a personal advisor known as heads for men, and until recently, handmaids for women. The secretive group has a strictly patriarchal structure in which men are the heads of the household, as you said, with power over their wives and families. The group has been described by some as cult-like. Margaret Atwood has talked about various charismatic groups. The group she based Handmaid's Tale on was People of Hope in New Jersey, not the South Bend People of Praise. But, of course, that term is so significant that they used Handmaid's Tale until recently. Atwood told The New York Times, I delayed writing it for about 3 years after that. I got the idea because I felt it was too crazy. Then I started noticing that a lot of the things I thought I was more or less making up were now happening. And indeed, more of them have happened since the publication of the book. There's a sect now, a Catholic charismatic spinoff sect, which calls the women handmaids. They don't go in for polygamy of this kind, but they do threaten the handmaids, according to the biblical verse I use in the book, sit down and shut up, she said. Now, again, that's a different charismatic Catholic group, a kind of spinoff, People of Hope. Explain the difference. And also, if you could respond to, I mean, the unfortunate questioning of Feinstein when she said to Amy Barrett, the dogma lives loudly within you, was then, you know, people took great umbrage of that. And she said, I can separate my religious views from my legal opinions. The dogma lives loudly within you was Feinstein's comment. And if you can talk about that and whether that will prevent people from questioning Amy Coney Barrett about her views and how they affect her legal decisions.
Well, just to go back to the People of Hope. So the People of Hope, I'm less familiar with, excuse me, but I would say that I have followed a number of folks who grew up in some of these covenanted communities. And there is a history of allegations, especially by folks who have chosen to leave it, of problematic authoritarianism. I think it's interesting to note that historically, there's nothing inherently conservative about the charismatic movement. So if you're having this personal relationship with the Holy Spirit and with God, God could also, you know, tell you to be a progressive Catholic, I suppose, too. But many charismatic movements have aligned themselves or are very similar to Pentecostalism in Protestantism. And so we have this sort of combining of conservative Catholicism with all of its teachings around gender, roles, anti-gay marriage, and these sorts of things that then get sort of connected with these charismatic groups. So I think what many of people's concern isn't that she's the member of a religious community. Obviously, you know, this is not simple anti-Catholicism. If being a Catholic was a problem for being on the Supreme Court, why do we have so many Catholic justices already? But it's this particular group, its secretiveness, and then also it does have, and she has specifically spoken about her own views on abortion, on even the death penalty in terms of church teaching on that, on gay marriage. I do think it's somewhat ironic. Opposed to the death penalty, yes. Opposed to abortion, opposed to gay marriage. I do think. Go ahead.
No, I wanted to ask you, given the fact that one of the apparent principles of People of Praise is that a wife must be submissive to the will of her husband, and that in this case, Amy Barrett's husband is a member of the group as well. What does this say about her ability to make independent decisions apart from what her husband might think when she's on the court?
Yeah, so I can't speak to that, you know, specifically, although, you know, it's possible that there could be somebody nominated to the court who has that belief and it's not known in a public way because of her membership in this group. It's known. And I think that is a fair question for her if she were to be nominated and at a confirmation hearing. So obviously, when the Senate is looking to confirm someone to such an important position, a lifelong position, I think all kinds of questions about someone's beliefs, including their religious beliefs and their membership in certain organizations, is fair game. Now, I think the Democrats are going to be in a tough position, as it's increasingly looking like this hearing could be happening before the election. So they have to be careful not to be appearing to ask her questions that are perceived by some as insulting her, anti-Catholic, insulting her religion. Obviously, Joe Biden and the Democrats have done a lot to reach out to religious voters, moderate religious voters during the campaign and wouldn't want to undo all that. I know there are conservative Catholics who proudly say the dogma, you know, lives in me, because Dianne Feinstein said. The only thing I can say is it must be that Amy Barrett's husband wants her to be on the Supreme Court, because it is somewhat ironic, you know, if that's what he's encouraging her to do, because it is somewhat ironic that in a group that believes in the submission of women, we have a woman from that group who is potentially going to be on the highest court in the land.
Before we go to a former member of People of Praise, I wanted to go to Amy Coney Barrett's views on the ACA. Extremely relevant. In a 2017 Law Review, she criticized Chief Justice John Roberts for voting to uphold the Affordable Care Act in 2013. She wrote, quote, "Chief Justice Roberts pushed the Affordable Care Act beyond its plausible meaning to save the statute. He construed the penalty imposed on those without health insurance as a tax, which permitted him to sustain the statute as a valid exercise of the taxing power. Had he treated the payment as the statute did, as a penalty, he would have had to invalidate the statute as lying behind Congress's commerce power." It's a little hard to understand, but it's extremely significant, because if Amy Coney Barrett was nominated, confirmed, and sat on the court before November 10th. Those are the date of the oral arguments on the ACA, which could strike the whole thing down. Heidi, your final comments on this.
Yeah, so I do think that that she is a conservative judge, and she is a conservative Catholic. And the Catholic Church in the United States has long supported the Affordable Care Act, especially after the accommodations were made for Catholic employers that didn't want to provide contraceptive coverage. So it'll be interesting to see if she sides with church leaders on that one or not. She has said that she would not have her faith affect her decisions as a judge. She had written a law review article once saying that judges would have to recuse themselves, for example, from capital punishment cases. She does at least have consistency on that pro-life issue, the capital punishment and abortion. But if she does get confirmed, it would be very interesting to see what she does. She may surprise us. Sometimes judges do very different things than we expect from them.
Heidi Schlumpf, we want to thank you so much for being with us, executive editor of the National Catholic Reporter. In 2018, she wrote the piece, "Prospective Supreme Court Nominee Puts Spotlight on People of Praise." When we come back, we'll be joined by a former member of the group who likens People of Praise to a cult. Stay with us. By Marissa Anderson. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As we continue to look at the background of Judge Amy Coney Barrett, the apparent frontrunner to replace Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg on the Supreme Court, President Trump said he'll announce a nominee on Saturday. Mitch McConnell appears to have the 51 votes he needs in the Senate to force a confirmation vote through before the election. We're looking at Amy Barrett's membership in a secretive Catholic group with rigid gender roles and a lifelong loyalty oath. We're now joined by a former member of People People of Praise, who's now speaking out against the group. Coralonica Theo was a People of Praise member for 5 years, from 1979 to 1984, after being forced to join the organization by her then-husband. She documented her experience in her memoir titled Banshee, Making Light of the Dark. Coral, thanks so much for joining us from Corvallis, Oregon. Can you describe People of Praise and what happened to you while you lived in the community?
Thank you for having me on your show, and I'm a fan of you and your show. I was a member of the People of Praise. Many call it a community, but I describe it as a cult in Corvallis, Oregon. I experienced abuse and torture by my husband, Marty Warner, Independence, Oregon, and the cult leaders, as well as shunning, shaming, and a smear campaign against me when I escaped and left. For safety, I legally changed my name and have lived under a state address protection program from my ex-husband for the past 20 years. Even though I was, I left the People of Praise cult, I didn't have any rights due to being married to my husband, who was a cult member. I was under the authority of my husband and his authoritarian head, Ed Brown. Under their authority, I was forced to attend meetings, but because I had defied leadership and their authority, I was forced to sit on the floor outside of their meetings in the hallway at the St. Mary's Catholic Church. There's dozens of witnesses that have seen how I was treated. What I would ask listeners to consider, even though they say this is a healthy group, to consider how I was treated and if this would be correct for Amy Barrett to be treated. One time I had a miscarriage in 1984, and I had to have a DNC surgery. After I returned from the hospital, I was forced to attend a People of Praise women's meeting, our handmaidens meetings. I had a head that was also a woman besides my husband. They wanted to go shopping, and I couldn't due to returning from surgery and feeling weak. I left the meeting to go home and rest, as my doctor had ordered. I was met by my husband and forced into the car, kidnapped against my will, where I was driven to the cult leader's home. I was interrogated until wee hours of the morning and psychologically abused. The next morning, the community was informed to shun me. I would never allow anyone to treat me this way today, and it traumatizes me to admit this was my life at that time. The trauma experienced by cult members. Oh, yes.
No, well, Cole, I wanted to ask you, in terms of some of the hair-raising descriptions in your memoir of what happened to you, I wanted to ask you if you could talk about some of those. You talk about this situation where the head that was assigned to you and your husband wanted to see the family budget, that he told you how many hours per day you could spend on particular chores, including 2 to 4 loads of laundry a day. This meddling directly in the day-to-day, in your day-to-day life and affairs with you and your family. And that you also mentioned that once you decided that you wanted to leave, that they threatened to try to have you committed to a mental institution.
They would call me mentally ill, and there was a time they had me under special counseling under Father Charles Harris, who was the head leader of the Corvallis People of Praise branch. He was from South Bend. But basically, there was just cruelty and bullying, and it was not much different than the Jim Jones cult. I shared with Heidi that my story is very much like the Handmaid's Tale series. And the Netflix series, 10-part documentary, The Keepers. Other things, yeah, there was always a list on my wall, a schedule, and men from the community would come unannounced to check on me to make sure I was on schedule and had done my chores. There was basically no privacy. And all of your personal, anything personal was given to your husband's head also. I wasn't allowed contraceptives and was supposed to have all the children God intended for me, no matter what my health was. I've had 8 children and 3 miscarriages in DNC, often when my health was failing.
And so can you talk about your decision to leave the group? Now, you're in Corvallis. Judge Amy Coney Barrett is in the original place of People of Praise, which is South Bend. And the reports are there are just something like 1,700 members of this group around the country. Talk finally about your choice to leave and the response of the group.
Well, I never wanted to join in the first place, but due to our marriage, I was forced to obey in all things through the duration of our 20-year marriage. But during the 5 years, especially in the People Praise cult, I was just forced to obey. And yes, we had Sunday meetings. We had women had Tuesday night meetings. The men had Thursday night meetings. There was community meetings on to help people within the community. There's not a lot of outside contact. In fact, our leaders would tell us how often we could see our family and our friends. And even the night my father died in 1984, he did not allow me to go see my father before he died. Those were just decisions made. And as I will say, the bottom line was cruelty. And members are in spiritual bondage. Some are afraid to leave. I believe I was an example. Perpetrators will show people what happens to others when you say no. It's very similar to domestic violence and how frightening an experience it is to leave. And I was shunned in the community, and because the People of Praise community in Corvallis had a widespread respect within the community, many of their members are leaders in the local St. Mary's Catholic Church, I was shunned even in stores. There was people who knew them, and so it was a very traumatic experience.
And what happened to your children when you left?
Well, when I left, eventually the community forced my husband to leave. It was kind of a long-term wait and see, but I would not go back in. And, of course, he was enraged that I would not obey, and he was looked upon as a husband that had a disobedient wife. And that was shameful to him, and then he was forced to leave. And it wasn't long after that I also left the Catholic Church. I honor everyone's right to believe as they want, but when there is abuse, I believe you need to leave. You need that doesn't that is with any toxic environment, and that helps the abusers know that you are not going to allow them to abuse you. And the church was of no help. I went to the priest there, and they were friends with Charles Harris, Father Charles Harris. So there was no help. And
Coral Annika Thiel, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Former member of the People of Praise Catholic community for 5 years, from 1979 to 84, forced to join the organization by her husband at the time. She documents her experience in her memoir. Next up, we go to the latest news that immigration authorities say they've stopped sending women detainees to a Georgia gynecologist accused of sterilizing the female prisoners without their consent. And we go back and look at the disturbing history of forced sterilization of Chicana women in Los Angeles. Stay with us.
Sin tu amor no puedo vivir. Te quiero y no niego, mi corazón es para ti. Te quiero y da miedo que pronto acabe de existir.
All that I have by Quetzal. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. In Georgia, immigration authorities have stopped sending immigrant female detainees held in the Irwin County Detention Center to a gynecologist accused of sterilizing the women prisoners without their consent. Dr. Mahendra Amin reportedly saw at least 60 women detained at the ICE jail, which is run by the private prison company LaSalle Corrections. On Tuesday, we interviewed the whistleblower nurse, Dawn Wooten, who worked at Irwin and said a woman that women held there called Dr. Amin a, quote, uterus collector? Well, for our next guest, the news that a doctor had given immigrant women unwanted sterilization sounded eerily familiar. Virginia Espino is the producer of the documentary No Más Bebés, or No More Babies. This is the film's trailer.
In East Los Angeles during the late 1960s and early 1970s, women were going to the county hospital to give birth. Some went home sterilized.
There are still beds here. Look. Inside, I feel pain remembering.
What makes you sad being here?
Who knows why, but I do feel sad.
Is this?
Oh, Mama.
This baby boy became a citizen 1 minute ago. His mother does not have immigration papers.
We're told they should be sterilized to save taxpayers' welfare.
Something drastic must be done about population growth.
The doctor walked in and said, "We cut your tubes." And I said, "Why?" He goes, "Well, you signed for it." I said, "Me?" I go, "I don't remember nothing." And I didn't tell my family. I didn't tell anybody.
They were extremely fearful being told that you need an emergency cesarean section. You can feel blood pouring down your leg. At that time, signing the consent for tubal ligation.
Some of them signed right in the midst of labor. Some of them don't even remember signing. Here it is, this young lawyer, and for the first time telling him, "Do you know that you've been sterilized?"
We are suing HEW for non-compliance or non-enforcement, non-monitoring of the sterilization regulation.
It was just the beginning of the emergence of the civil rights movement in the Latino community.
We were talking about abortion rights, all of the issues of feminism at that time. The idea that somebody could be forcibly sterilized like seemed like something out of a mental institution out of the 1920s.
It's a claim that we're part of a greater goal of sterilizing the Mexican population that immigrates to Los Angeles. I mean, I'm offended by that. That's not what we did.
Felt when I was young. It doesn't change the way I feel in my heart now that I'm older. But it's there all the time. It's like when you bury somebody, you're always going to carry it on your head.
That's the trailer for No Más Bebés, No More Babies. It aired on PBS's Independent Lens in 2016, tells the story of how some 46 years ago, a whistleblower doctor spoke out about a large number of tubal ligations performed on mostly Chicana patients at the Los Angeles County Hospital. Dr. Bernard Rosenfeld observed many women who came to the hospital for emergency C-section deliveries left the hospital sterilized. 10 women of the women filed a class action lawsuit in federal court in a case known as Madrigal versus Quilligan. In this clip from the film, we hear from plaintiff Maria Hurtado.
That's what I heard them saying. No more. The Mexican women are having too many kids, and they were having to figure out a way to slow it down.
You speak English, they treat you one way. You don't speak English, they treat you another way. That's how I see it.
Y el doctor lo único que decía es, "Mama."
The only thing that the doctor said was, "Mama, mama," because he wouldn't say sign here or here. They couldn't say anything. They only signaled "mama."
One of the women who was sterilized without her consent in the 70s at the Los Angeles County USC Medical Center. From where we go to Virginia Espino, the film's producer, lead historian. She's also a lecturer with the UCLA Department of Chicana, Chicano, and Central American Studies. She made the film with her friend, the Academy Award-nominated filmmaker Renee Tajima Pena. Before then, the women in the lawsuit had not had much opportunity to describe their experiences. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Professor Espino. It's great to have you with us. If you can lay out what happened and what this lawsuit was about and what came of it.
It was
The events occurred in the early 1970s when women would go to the L.A. County Hospital for emergency cesareans. So the L.A. County Hospital wasn't a place where people would go and plan to deliver their child. In some cases, you did have people opting for that as a safe place. But you had other people going there because they were in pain, in trauma, they were bleeding, they were having complications. And that was the case of the Madrigal 10, who would eventually file a lawsuit against the hospital. They would go to the hospital for a emergency cesarean in full labor. And at that time, they were approached by hospital staff, sometimes doctors, sometimes nurses, sometimes social workers, about signing consent forms for tubal ligation. Quite often, they did not understand the terminology. They did not, in some cases, understand the language. Many of them spoke primarily Spanish. And in some cases, they were just under duress from pain, from labor. And so they didn't quite know what was happening to them. In one case, for example, Melvina Hernandez went for 3 years after her tubal ligation wearing an IUD because she did not know she had that surgery performed on her.
And Professor Espino, could you talk somewhat about the difficulty you had in actually documenting what had happened and the problems you had in accessing records of what had occurred? As I mentioned in yesterday's show, this kind of stuff had been happening in Puerto Rico in the late 1940s and early 1950s, this mass sterilization of Puerto Rican women of childbearing age on the island. But again, finding the documentation, it was always difficult.
Well, in this case, I think it's unique because you had the explosion of the Chicano movement occurring at the same time that these sterilizations were made public. So you had people consciously saving these records. Professor Carlos Vélez Ibáñez donated his expert witness testimony to UCLA archives, the Chicano Research Center there. And he made available court testimony. He made available some of the audio that you hear in the film was what he recorded when he was an expert witness. He actually interviewed the women in the 1970s, and he saved all that material and donated it to the library. It was harder to get the court records. Excuse me. It was harder to get the court records because they had been lost. They had been misplaced. They had been misfiled.
And in terms of when you hear what's been going on at the Irwin Center, Detention Center in Georgia now, and putting what's happening currently in context from the history that you've mined here, could you make some connections there?
Absolutely. It feels like definitely the Georgia case is mirroring what is taking place or what had taken place in Los Angeles. You have people not fully understanding the procedures that are being performed on them. You have miscommunication. You have a code of silence. Thankfully, you have a whistleblower who is breaking that code of silence. But at the LA County Hospital in the 1970s, you had a code of silence where people did not speak out against this abuse. People normalized approaching women while they were in labor and asking them to sign over their fertility. You know, that was a normal practice that was taking place on a day-to-day basis.
And of course, the consent form was in English. While they lost the lawsuit, this wasn't before a jury, but before one judge, a white male judge.
Yes.
Talk about the changes that resulted from the bravery of these women coming forward.
It really rallied the community. You had protests. You had the newspaper covering this issue at a time that it didn't really cover the ethnic Mexican community. You had a waiting period implemented so that it became illegal to approach a woman while she was in labor regarding tubal ligation. So a 72 waiting period wasn't implemented. You also had of recommendations or legislation put into place that required consent forms be in the language of the patient. So some of those were monumental changes that occurred because of this lawsuit.
Well, Virginia
and because
Espino,
these women came forward.
We have to leave it there, but we encourage people to see this amazing documentary. Producer and lead historian for the film No Mas Babies, No More Babies, lecturer with UCLA Department of Chicano and Central American Studies. The film aired on PBS Independent Lens in 2016 is now available on demand on Vimeo in both English and Spanish. We will link to it. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe, wear a mask, save lives.